Mr. Tubbs was no magician, said Norrell, nor did I ever hear that he claimed to be one. But had he been the greatest magician in Christendom, he would still have been wrong to wish for the company of fairies. A more poisonous race, or one more inimical to England, has never existed. There have been far too many magicians, too idle or ignorant to pursue a proper course of study, who instead bent all their energies upon acquiring a fairy servant. And when they got such a servant, they depended upon him to complete all their business for them. English history is full of such men, and some, I'm glad to say, were punished for it as they deserved. Look at Bludworth.
Footnote 5. Simon Bludworth's fairy servant came to him quite out of the blue, offering his services, and saying he wished to be known as Buckler. As every English schoolchild nowadays can tell you, Bludworth would have done better to have inquired further, and to have probed a little deeper into who precisely Buckler was, and why exactly he had come out of fairy with no other aim than to become the servant of a third-rate English magician. Buckler was very quick at all sorts of magic, and Bludworth's business in the little wool town of Bradford-on-Avon grew and prospered. Only once did Buckler cause any sort of difficulty, when, in a sudden fit of rage, he destroyed a little book belonging to Lord Lovell's chaplain. The longer Buckler remained with Bludworth, the stronger he became. And the first thing that Buckler did when he became stronger was to change his appearance. His dusty rags became a suit of good clothes. A rusty pair of scissors that he had stolen from a locksmith in the town became a sword. His thin, piebald fox face became a pale and handsome human one, and he grew very suddenly 2 or 3 feet taller. And this, he was quick to impress on Mrs. Bludworth and her daughters, was his true appearance. The other, merely an enchantment he had been under. On a fine May morning in 1310, when Bludworth was away from home, Mrs. Bludworth discovered a tall cupboard standing in the corner of her kitchen, where no cupboard had ever been before. When she asked Buckler about it, he said immediately that it was a magical cupboard, and that he had brought it there. He said that he had always thought that it was a pity that magic was not more commonly used in England. He said it pained him to see Mrs. Bludworth and her daughters washing and sweeping and cooking and cleaning from dawn to dusk, when they ought, in his opinion, to be sitting on cushions in jewel-spangled gowns eating comfits. This, thought Mrs. Bludworth, was very good sense. Buckler said how he had often reproved her husband for his failure to make Mrs. Bludworth's life pleasant and easy, but Bludworth had not paid him any attention. Mrs. Bludworth said she was not a bit surprised. Buckler said that if she stepped inside the cupboard, she would find herself in a magical place where she could learn spells that would make any work finished in an instant, make her appear beautiful in the eyes of all who beheld her, make large piles of gold appear whenever she wished it, make her husband obey her in all things, etc., etc. How many spells were there? Asked Mrs. Bludworth.
About 3, thought Buckler.
Were they hard to learn?
Oh, no. Very easy.
Would it take long?
No, not long. She would be back in time for Mass.
17 people entered Buckler's cupboard that morning, and were never seen again in England. Among them were Mrs. Bludworth, her 2 youngest daughters, her 2 maids, and 2 manservants, Mrs. Bludworth's uncle, and 6 neighbours. Only Margaret Bludworth, Bludworth's eldest daughter, refused to go. The Raven King sent 2 magicians from Newcastle to investigate the matter, and it is from their written accounts that we have this tale. The chief witness was Margaret, who told how, on his return, "My poor father went purposely into the cupboard to try if he could rescue them, though I begged him not to. He has not come out again." 200 years later, Dr. Martin Pale was journeying through Faerie. At the castle of John Hollyshoes, an ancient and powerful fairy prince, he discovered a human child, about 7 or 8 years old, very pale and starved-looking. She said her name was Anne Bludworth, and she had been in fairy, she thought, about 2 weeks. She had been given work to do, washing a great pile of dirty pots. She said she had been washing them steadily since she arrived, and when she was finished, she would go home to see her parents and sisters. She thought she would be finished in a day or two. Mr. Norrell made many new acquaintances, but kindled no pure flame of friendship in the hearts of any. In general, London found him disappointing. He did no magic, cursed no one, foretold nothing. Once at Mrs. Godston's house, he was heard to remark that he thought it might rain, but this, if a prophecy, was a disappointing one, for it did not rain. Indeed, no rain fell until the following Saturday. He hardly ever spoke of magic, and when he did, it was like a history lesson, and no one could bear to listen to him. He rarely had a good word to say for any other magician, except once when he praised a magician of the last century, Francis Sutton Grove. Footnote 6. Francis Sutton Grove, 1682 to 1765, theoretical magician. He wrote two books, De Generibus, Artium Magicarum Anglorum, 1741, and Prescriptions and Descriptions, 1749. Even Mr. Norrell, Sutton Grove's greatest, and indeed only, admirer, thought that Prescriptions and Descriptions, wherein he attempted to lay down rules for practical magic, was abominably bad. And Mr. Norrell's pupil, Jonathan Strange, loathed it so much that he tore his copy into pieces and fed it to a tinker's donkey. See Life of Jonathan Strange by John Segundus, 1820, publisher John Murray. The Generibus Artium Magicarum Anglorum was reputed to be the dreariest book in the canon of English magic, which contains many tedious works. It was the first attempt by an Englishman to define the areas of magic that the modern magician ought to study. According to Sutton Grove, these numbered 38,945, and he listed them all under different heads. Sutton Grove foreshadows the great Mr. Norrell in one other way. None of his lists make any mention of the magic traditionally ascribed to birds or wild animals, and Sutton Grove purposely excludes those kinds of magic for which it is customary to employ fairies, for example, bringing back the dead.
"But I thought, sir," said Mr. Lascelles, "that Sutton Grove was unreadable. I've always heard that De Generibus Artium was entirely unreadable." "Oh," said Mr. Norrell, "how it fares as an amusement for ladies and gentlemen, I do not know. But I do not think that the serious student of magic can value Sutton Grove too highly. In Sutton Grove, he will find the first attempt to define those areas of magic that the modern magician ought to study, all laid out in lists and tables. To be sure, Sutton Grove's system of classification is often erroneous. Perhaps that is what you meant by unreadable. Nevertheless, I know of no more pleasant sight in the world than a dozen or so of his lists. The student may run his eyes over them and think, 'I know this,' or 'I have this still to do.' And there before him is work enough for 4, perhaps 5 years.
The tale of the statues and the Cathedral of York grew so stale in the retelling that people began to wonder if Mr. Norrell had ever done anything else, and Mr. Drawlight was obliged to invent some new examples.
"But what can this magician do, Drawlight?" asked Mrs. Godstone one evening when Mr. Norrell was not present.
"Oh, madam," cried Drawlight, "what can he not do? Why, it was only a winter or so ago that in York, which, as you may know, madam, is Mr. Norrell's native city, a great storm came out of the north and blew everybody's washing into the mud and snow. And so the alderman, thinking to spare the ladies of the town the labour of washing everything again, applied to Mr. Norrell, and he sent a troop of fairies to wash it all anew. And all the holes in people's shirts and nightcaps and petticoats were mended, and all the frayed edges were made whole and good again. And everybody said that they'd never seen such a dazzling whiteness in all their days."
This particular story became very popular, and raised Mr. Norrell in everyone's estimation for several weeks that summer. And consequently, when Mr. Norrell spoke, as he sometimes did, of modern magic, most of his audience supposed that this was the sort of thing he must mean. But if the ladies and gentlemen whom Mr. Norrell met in London's drawing rooms and dining parlours were generally disappointed in him, then he was becoming equally dissatisfied with them. He complained constantly to Mr. Drawlight of the frivolous questions that they put to him, and said that the cause of English magic had not been furthered one whit by the hours he had spent in their company. One dull Wednesday morning, at the end of September, Mr. Norrell and Mr. Drawlight were seated together in the library in Hanover Square. Mr. Drawlight was in the middle of a long tale of something that Mr. F. had said in order to insult Lord S., and what Lady D. had thought about it all, when Mr. Norrell suddenly said,
"I would be grateful, Mr. Drawlight, if you could advise me on the following important point. Has anybody informed the Duke of Portland of my arrival in London?"
7. Duke of Portland, Prime Minister, and First Lord of the Treasury, 1807 to 09.
"Ah, sir," cried Drawlight, "only you, with your modest nature, could suppose it possible. I assure you, all the ministers have heard of the extraordinary Mr. Norrell by now."
"But if that is the case," said Mr. Norrell, "then why has His Grace sent me no message? No, I begin to think that they must be entirely ignorant of my existence. And so, Mr. Drawlight, I would be grateful if you could inform me of any connections in government
that you may have to whom I could apply.
The government, sir, replied Mr. Drawlight.
I came here to be useful, said Mr. Norrell plaintively. I'd hoped by now to play some distinguished part in the struggle against the French.
If you feel yourself neglected, sir, then I am heartily sorry for it, cried Drawlight. But there is no need, I do assure you. There are ladies and gentlemen all over town who would be happy to see any little tricks or illusions you might like to show us one evening after dinner. You must not be afraid of overwhelming us. Our nerves are all pretty strong.
Mr. Norrell said nothing.
Well, sir, said Mr. Drawlight,
with a smooth smile of his white teeth and a conciliatory look in his dark, liquid eyes.
We must not argue about it. I only wish I were able to oblige you, but as you see, it is entirely out of my power. The government has its sphere, I have mine.
In fact, Mr. Drawlight knew several gentlemen in various government posts who might be very glad to meet Mr. Drawlight's friend, and to listen to what that friend might have to say, in return for a promise from Mr. Drawlight never to tell one or two curious things he knew about them. But the truth was, Mr. Drawlight could see no advantage to himself in introducing Mr. Norrell to any of these gentlemen. He preferred to keep Mr. Norrell in the drawing-rooms and dining-parlours of London, where he hoped, in time, to persuade him to perform those little tricks and whatnot that Mr. Drawlight's acquaintances longed to see. Mr. Norrell began writing urgent letters to gentlemen in government, which he showed to Mr. Drawlight before giving them to Childermas to deliver. But the gentlemen in government did not reply. Mr. Drawlight had warned Mr. Norrell that they would not. Gentlemen in government are generally kept pretty busy. A week or so later, Mr. Drawlight was invited to a house in Soho Square to hear a famous Italian soprano newly arrived from Rome. Naturally, Mr. Norrell was invited too. But on arriving at the house, Drawlight could not find the magician among the crowd. Lascelles was leaning upon the mantelpiece in conversation with some other gentleman. Drawlight went up to him and inquired if he knew where Mr. Norrell was.
Oh, said Mr. Lascelles, he's gone to pay a visit to Sir Walter Pearl. Mr. Norrell has important information which he wishes conveyed to the Duke of Portland immediately, and Sir Walter Pearl is the man that Mr. Norrell intends to honour with the message.
Portland? Cried another gentleman. What? Are the ministers got so desperate as that? Are they consulting magicians?
You have run away with the wrong idea, smiled Mr. Lascelles. It is all Norrell's own doing. He intends to offer his services to the government. It seems he has a plan to defeat the French by magic. But I think it highly improbable that he will persuade the ministers to listen to him. What with the French at their throats on the continent, and everybody else at their throats in Parliament, I doubt if a more harassed set of gentlemen is to be found anywhere, or one with less attention to spare for a Yorkshire gentleman's eccentricities.
Like the hero of a fairy tale, Mr. Norrell had discovered that the power to do what he wished had been his own all along. Even a magician must have relations, and so it happened that there was a distant connection of Mr. Norrell, on his mother's side, who had once made himself highly disagreeable to Mr. Norrell by writing him a letter. To prevent such a thing ever occurring again, Mr. Norrell had made this man a present of £800, which was what the man wanted. But I'm sorry to say that this failed to suppress Mr. Norrell's mother's relative, who was steeped in villainy, and he had written a second letter to Mr. Norrell, in which he heaped thanks and praise upon his benefactor, and declared that, henceforth I shall consider myself and my friends as belonging to your interest, and we hold ourselves ready to vote at the next election in accordance with your noble wishes, and if in time to come it should appear that any service of mine might be useful to you, your commands will only honour and elevate in the opinion of the world your humble and devoted servant, Wendell Markworthy.
Thus far, Mr. Norrell had never found it necessary to elevate Mr. Markworthy in the opinion of the world by honouring him with any commands. But it now appeared, it was Childermas that had found it out, that Mr. Markworthy had used the money to secure for himself and his brother clerkships in the East India Company. They had gone to India, and 10 years later had returned very rich men. Having never received any instructions from Mr. Norrell, his first patron, as to which way to vote, Mr. Markworthy had followed the lead of Mr. Bonnell, his superior at the East India Company, and had encouraged all his friends to do the same. He had made himself very useful to Mr. Bonnell, who was in turn a great friend of the politician Sir Walter Pole. In the busy worlds of trade and government, this gentleman owes that one a favour, while he in turn is owed a favour by someone else, and so on until a chain is formed of promises and obligations. In this case, the chain extended all the way from Mr. Norrell to Sir Walter Pole, and Sir Walter Pole was now a minister. Chapter 6. Magic is not respectable, sir. October 1807. It was a difficult time to be a minister. The war went from bad to worse, and the government was universally detested. As each fresh catastrophe came to the public's notice, some small share of blame might attach itself to this or that person. But in general, everyone united in blaming the ministers, and they, poor things, had no one to blame but each other, which they did more and more frequently. It was not that the ministers were dull-witted. On the contrary, there were some brilliant men among them. Nor were they, upon the whole, bad men. Several led quite blameless domestic lives and were remarkably fond of children, music, dogs, landscape painting. Yet so unpopular was the government that had it not been for the careful speeches of the Foreign Secretary, it would have been almost impossible to get any piece of business through the House of Commons. The Foreign Secretary was a quite peerless orator. No matter how low the government stood in the estimation of everyone, when the Foreign Secretary stood up and spoke, ah, how different everything seemed then. How quickly was every bad thing discovered to be the fault of the previous administration, an evil set of men who wedded general stupidity to wickedness of purpose. As for the present ministry, the Foreign Secretary said that not since the days of antiquity had the world seen gentlemen so virtuous, so misunderstood, and so horribly misrepresented by their enemies. They were all as wise as Solomon, as noble as Caesar, and as courageous as Mark Antony, and no one in the world so much resembled Socrates in point of honesty as the Chancellor of the Exchequer. But in spite of all these virtues and abilities, none of the ministers' plans to defeat the French ever seemed to come to anything, and even their cleverness was complained of. Country gentlemen who read in their newspapers the speeches of this or that minister would mutter to themselves that he was certainly a clever fellow. But the country gentlemen were not made comfortable by this thought. The country gentlemen had a strong suspicion that cleverness was somehow un-British. That sort of restless, unpredictable brilliance belonged most of all to Britain's arch-enemy, the Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte. The country gentlemen could not approve it. Sir Walter Pole was 42, and I'm sorry to say, quite as clever as anyone else in the cabinet. He had quarrelled with most of the great politicians of the age at one time or another, and once, when they were both very drunk, had been struck over the head with a bottle of Madeira by Richard Brinsley Sheridan. Afterwards, Sheridan remarked to the Duke of York, "Pole accepted my apologies in a handsome gentlemanlike fashion. Happily, he is such a plain man that one scar, more or less, can make no significant difference." To my mind, he was not so very plain. True, his features were all extremely bad. He had a great face half as long again as other faces, with a great nose, quite sharp at the end, stuck into it. Two dark eyes like clever bits of coal, and two little stubby eyebrows, like very small fish swimming bravely in a great sea of face. Yet, taken together, all these ugly parts made a rather pleasing whole. If you had seen that face in repose, proud and not a little melancholy, you would have imagined that it must always look so, that no face in existence could be so ill-adapted to express feeling. But you could have not been more wrong. Nothing was more characteristic of Sir Walter Pole than surprise. His eyes grew large, his eyebrows rose half an inch upon his face, and he leant suddenly backwards, and altogether he resembled nothing so much as a figure in the engravings of Mr. Rowlandson or Mr. Gilray. In public life, surprise served Sir Walter very well. "But surely," he cried, "you cannot mean to say." And always supposing that the gentleman who was so foolish as to suggest, in Sir Walter's hearing, was no friend or yours, or if you had that sort of mischief in you that likes to see blunt wits confounded by sharp ones, you would be entertained. On days when he was full of cheerful malice, Sir Walter was better than a play in Drury Lane. Dull gentlemen in both houses grew perplexed and avoided him when they could. Old Lord So-and-so waves his stick at Sir Walter as he trots down the little stone passage that connects the House of Commons to the Horse Guards, and cries over his shoulder, "I will not speak to you, sir. You twist my words. You give me meanings I never intended." Once, while making a speech to a mob in the city, Sir Walter had memorably likened England and her politicians to an orphaned young lady left in the care of a pack of lecherous, avaricious old men. These scoundrels, far from offering the young lady protection from the wicked world, stole her inheritance and plundered her house. And if Sir Walter's audience stumbled on some of his vocabulary, the product of an excellent classical education, it did not much matter. All of them were capable of imagining the poor young lady standing on her bed in her petticoats while the leading Whig politicians of the day ransacked her closets and sold off all her bits of things to the ragman. And all the young gentlemen found themselves pleasantly shocked by the picture. Sir Walter had a generous spirit and was often kind-hearted. He told someone once that he hoped his enemies all had reason to fear him and his friends reason to love him. And I think that upon the whole, they did. His cheerful manner, his kindness and cleverness, the great station he now held in the world, these were even more to his credit, as he maintained them in the face of problems that would almost certainly have brought down a lesser man. Sir Walter was distressed for money. I do not mean that he merely lacked for cash. Poverty is one thing, Sir Walter's debts quite another. Miserable situation, and all the more bitter since it was no fault of his. He had never been extravagant, and he had certainly never been foolish. But he was the son of one imprudent man and the grandson of another. Sir Walter had been born in debt. Had he been a different sort of man, then all might have been well. Had he been at all inclined to the navy, then he might have made his fortune in prize money. Had he loved farming, he might have improved his lands and made his money with corn. Had he even been a minister 50 years before, he might have lent out treasury money at 20% interest and pocketed the profit. But what can a modern politician do? He is more likely to spend money than make it. Some years ago, his friends in government had got him the position of Secretary in Ordinary to the Office of Supplication, for which he received a special hat, a small piece of ivory, and £700 a year. There were no duties attached to the place, because no one could remember what the Office of Supplication was supposed to do, or what the small piece of ivory was for. But then Sir Walter's friends went out, and new ministers came in, declaring that they were going to abolish sinecures, and among the many offices and places which they pruned from the tree of government was the Office of Supplication. By the spring of 1807, it seemed as if Sir Walter's political career must be pretty much at an end. The last election had cost him almost £2,000. His friends were almost frantic. One of these friends, Lady Winsell, went to Bath, where, at a concert of Italian music, she made the acquaintance of some people called Wintertown, a widow and her daughter. A week later, Lady Winsell wrote to Sir Walter, "It is exactly what I have always wished for you. Her mother is all for a great marriage, and will make no difficulties. Or at least, if she does, then I rely upon you to charm them away. As for the money, I tell you, my dear friend, when they named the sum that is to be hers, tears sprang to my eyes. What would you say to 1,000 a year? I will say nothing of the young person herself. When you have seen her, you shall praise her to me much more ably than ever I could to you." At about 3 o'clock upon the same day that Mr. Drawlight attended the recital by the Italian lady, Lucas, Mr. Norrell's footman, knocked upon the door of a house in Brunswick Square, where Mr. Norrell had been summoned to meet Sir Walter. Mr. Norrell was admitted to the house and was shown to a very fine room upon the first floor. The walls were hung with a series of gigantic paintings in gilded frames of great complexity, all depicting the city of Venice. But the day was overcast, a cold stormy rain had set in, and Venice, that city built of equal parts of sunlit marble and sunlit sea, was drowned in a London gloom. Its aquamarine blues and cloud whites and glints of gold were dulled to the greys and greens of drowned things. From time to time, the wind flung a little sharp rain against the window, a melancholy sound, and in the grey light, the well-polished surfaces of tulip-wood chiffoniers and walnut writing tables had all become black mirrors, darkly reflecting one another. For all its splendour, the room was peculiarly comfortless. There were no candles to light the gloom, and no fire to take off the chill. It was as if the housekeeping was under the direction of someone with excellent eyesight who never felt the cold. Sir Walter Pole rose to receive Mr. Norrell and begged the honour of presenting Mrs. Wintertown and her daughter, Miss Wintertown. Though Sir Walter spoke of two ladies, Mr. Norrell could perceive only one, a lady of mature years, great dignity, a magisterial aspect. This puzzled Mr. Norrell. He thought Sir Walter must be mistaken, and yet it would be rude to contradict Sir Walter so early in the interview. In a state of some confusion, Mr. Norrell bowed to the magisterial lady.
"I'm very glad to meet you, sir," said Sir Walter. "I've heard a great deal about you. It seems to me that London talks of very little else but the extraordinary Mr. Norrell."
And turning to the magisterial lady, Sir Walter said,
"Mr. Norrell is a magician, ma'am, person of great reputation in his native county of Yorkshire."
The magisterial lady stared at Mr. Norrell.
"You are not at all what I expected, Mr. Norrell," remarked Sir Walter. "I'd been told you were a practical magician. I hope you are not offended, sir. It is merely what I was told, and I must say that it is a relief to me to see that you are nothing of the sort. London is plagued with a great number of mock sorcerers, who trick the people out of their money by promising them all sorts of unlikely things. I wonder, have you seen Vinculus, who has a little booth outside Sir Christopher Lestocq's? He's the worst of them." You are a theoretical magician, I imagine,"
Sir Walter smiled encouragingly.
"But they tell me that you have something to ask me, sir."
Mr. Norrell begged Sir Walter's pardon, but said that he was indeed a practical magician. Sir Walter looked surprised. Mr. Norrell hoped very earnestly that he would not, by this admission, lose Sir Walter's good opinion.
No, by no means," murmured Sir Walter politely. "The misapprehension under which you labour," said Mr. Norrell, "by which I mean, of course, the belief that all practical magicians must be charlatans, arises from the shocking idleness of English magicians in the last 200 years. I have performed one small feat of magic, which the people in York were kind enough to say they found astounding. And yet I tell you, Sir Walter, any magician of modest talent might have done as much. This general lethargy has deprived our great nation of its best support and left us defenceless. It is this deficiency which I hope to supply. Other magicians may be able to neglect their duty, but I cannot. I am come, Sir Walter, to offer you my help in our present difficulties." "Our present difficulties," said Sir Walter. "You mean the war?"
He opened his small black eyes very wide.
"My dear Mr. Norrell, what has the war to do with magic, or magic to do with the war? I believe I've heard what you did in York. I hope the housewives were grateful, but I scarcely see how we can apply such magic to the war. True, soldiers get very dirty, but then you know," and he began to laugh, "they have other things to think of."
Poor Mr. Norrell. He had not heard Drawlight's story of how the fairies had washed the people's clothes, and it came as a great shock to him. He assured Sir Walter that he had never in his life washed linen, not by magic, nor by any other means, and he told Sir Walter what he had really done. But curiously, though Mr. Norrell was able to work feats of the most breathtaking wonder, he was only able to describe them in his usual dry manner, so that Sir Walter was left with the impression that the spectacle of 500,000 stone figures in York Cathedral all speaking together had been a rather dull affair, and that he had been fortunate in being elsewhere at the time.
"Indeed," he said. "Well, that's most interesting. But I still do not quite understand how—"
Just at that moment, someone coughed, and the moment that Sir Walter heard the cough, he stopped speaking as if to listen. Mr. Norrell looked around. In the furthest, most shadowy corner of the room, a young woman in a white gown lay upon a sofa, with a white shawl wrapped tightly around her. She lay quite still. One hand pressed a handkerchief to her mouth. Her posture, her stillness, everything about her conveyed the strongest impression of pain and ill health. So certain had Mr. Norrell been that the corner was unoccupied, that he was almost as startled by her sudden appearance as if she had come there by someone else's magic. As he watched, she was seized by a fit of coughing that continued for some moments, and during that time Sir Walter appeared most uncomfortable. He did not look at the young woman, though he looked everywhere else in the room. He picked up a gilt ornament from a little table by his side, turned it over, looked at its underneath, put it down again. Finally, he coughed, a brief clearing of the throat, as though to suggest that everyone coughed. Coughing was the most natural thing in the world. Coughing could never, under any circumstances, be cause for alarm. The young woman upon the sofa came at last to the end of her own coughing fit, and lay quite still and quiet, though her breathing did not seem to come easily. Mr. Norrell's gaze travelled from the young lady to the great gloomy painting that hung above her, and he tried to recollect what he'd been speaking of.
"It is a marriage," said the majestic lady. "I beg your pardon, madam," said Mr. Norrell.
But the lady only nodded in the direction of the painting and bestowed a stately smile upon Mr. Norrell. The painting which hung above the young lady showed, like every other picture in the room, Venice. Cities are, for the most part, built upon hills. Their streets rise and fall. And it occurred to Mr. Norrell that Venice, being built upon the sea, must be the flattest as well as the queerest city in the world. It was the flatness which made the painting look so much like an exercise in perspective. Statues, columns, domes, palaces and cathedrals stretched away to where they met a vast, melancholy sky, while the sea that lapped at the walls of those buildings was crowded with ornately carved and gilded barges, and those strange black Venetian vessels that so much resemble the slippers of ladies in mourning.
"It depicts the symbolic marriage of Venice to the Adriatic," said the lady, whom we must now presume to be Mrs. Wintertown. "A curious Italian ceremony. The paintings which you see in this room were all bought by the late Mr. Wintertown during his travels on the continent, and when he and I were married, they were his wedding gift to me. The artist, an Italian, was then quite unknown in England. Later, emboldened by the patronage he received from Mr. Wintertown, he came to London."
Her manner of speech was as stately as her person. After each sentence, she paused to give Mr. Norrell time to be impressed by the information it contained.
"And when my dear Emma is married," she continued, "these paintings shall be my wedding present to her and Sir Walter."
Mr. Norrell inquired if Miss Wintertown and Sir Walter were to be married soon.
"In 10 days' time," answered Mrs. Wintertown triumphantly.
Mr. Norrell offered his congratulations.
"You are a magician, sir," said Mrs. Wintertown. "I'm sorry to hear it. It is a profession I have a particular dislike to."
She looked keenly at him as she said so, as though her disapproval might in itself be enough to make him renounce magic instantly and take up some other occupation. When he did not, she turned to her prospective son-in-law.
"My own stepmother, Sir Walter, placed great faith in a magician. After my father's death, he was always in the house. One could enter a room one was quite sure was empty and find him in a corner half hidden by a curtain, or asleep upon the sofa with his dirty boots on. He was the son of a leather tanner, and his low origins were frankly displayed in all he did. He had long, dirty hair and a face like a dog, but he sat at our table like a gentleman. My stepmother deferred to him all she did, and for 7 years he governed our lives completely."
"And your own opinion was disregarded, ma'am?" said Sir Walter. "I'm surprised at that."
Mrs. Winterton laughed.
"I was only a child of 8 or 9 when it began, Sir Walter. His name was Dreamditch, and he told us constantly how happy he was to be our friend, though my brother and I were equally constant in assuring him that we considered him no friend of ours. But he only smiled at us like a dog that had learned how to smile and does not know how to leave off. Do not misunderstand me, Sir Walter. My stepmother was in many ways an excellent woman. My father's esteem for her was such that he left her 600 a year in the care of his 3 children. Her only weakness was foolishly to doubt her own capabilities. My father believed that in understanding and in knowledge of right and wrong, and in many other things, women are men's equals, and I am entirely of his opinion. My stepmother should not have shrunk from the charge. When Mr. Wintertown died, I did not."
"No, indeed, ma'am," murmured Sir Walter.
"Instead," continued Mrs. Wintertown, "she placed all her faith in the magician Dreamditch. He had not an ounce of magic in him, and was constantly obliged to invent some. He made rules for my brother, my sister, and me, which he assured my stepmother would keep us safe. We wore purple ribbons tied tightly around our chests. In our room, 6 places were laid at the table, one for each of us, and one for each of the spirits which Dreamditch said looked after us. He told us their names. What do you suppose they were, Sir Walter?"
"I have not the least idea in the world, ma'am."
Mrs. Wintertown laughed.
"Meadow lace, Robin Summerfly and Buttercup. My brother, Sir Walter, who resembled myself in independence of spirit, would often say in my stepmother's hearing, "Damn Meadowlace, damn Robin Summerfly, damn Buttercup." And she, poor silly woman, would plead very piteously with him to stop. They did us no good, those fairy spirits. My sister became ill. Often I went to her room and found Dreamditch there, stroking her pale cheeks, an unresisting hand with his long, yellow, unclean fingernails. He was almost weeping, the fool. He would have saved her if he could. He made spells, but she died. A beautiful child, Sir Walter. For years I hated my stepmother's magician. For years I thought him a wicked man. But in the end, Sir Walter, I knew him to be nothing but a sad and pitiful fool. Sir Walter turned in his chair. "Miss Wintertown," he said, "you spoke, but I did not hear what it was you said."
"Emma, what is it?"
cried Mrs. Wintertown. There was a soft sigh from the sofa. Then a quiet, clear voice said,
"I said that you were quite wrong, Mama."
"Am I, my love?" Mrs. Wintertown, whose character was so forceful and whose opinions were handed down to people in the manner of Moses distributing the commandments, did not appear in the least offended when her daughter contradicted her. Indeed, she seemed almost pleased about it.
"Of course," said Miss Wintertown, "we must have magicians. Who else can interpret England's history to us, and in particular her northern history, her black northern king? Our common historians cannot."
There was silence for a moment.
"I'm fond of history," she said.
"I did not know that," said Sir Walter.
"Ah, Sir Walter," cried Mrs. Wintertown. "Dear Emma does not waste her energies upon novels like other young women. Her reading has been extensive. She knows more of biography and poetry than any young woman I know."
"Yet I hope," said Sir Walter eagerly, leaning over the back of his chair to speak to his betrothed, "that you like novels as well. And then, you know, we could read to each other. What is your opinion of Mrs. Radcliffe, of Madame D'Arblay?"
But what Miss Wintertown thought of these distinguished ladies, Sir Walter did not discover, for she was seized by a second fit of coughing, which obliged her to struggle, with an appearance of great effort, into a sitting position. He waited some moments for an answer, but when her coughing had subsided, she lay back on the sofa as before, with looks of pain and exhaustion, and closed her eyes. Mr. Norrell wondered that no one thought to go to her assistance. There seemed to be a sort of conspiracy in the room to deny that the poor young woman was ill. No one asked if they could bring her anything. No one suggested that she go to bed, which Mr. Norrell, who was often ill himself, imagined would be by far the best thing for her.
"Mr. Norrell," said Sir Walter, "I cannot claim to understand what this help is that you offer us."
"Oh, as to particulars," Mr. Norrell said, "I know as little of warfare as the generals and admirals do of magic. And yet—"
"But whatever it is," continued Sir Walter, "I'm sorry to say that it will not do. Magic is not respectable, sir. It is not—" Sir Walter searched for a word. "Serious. The government cannot meddle with such things. Even this innocent little chat that you and I have had today is likely to cause us a little embarrassment when people get to hear of it. Frankly, Mr. Norrell, had I understood better what you were intending to propose today, I would not have agreed to meet you."
Sir Walter's manner, as he said all this, was far from unkind. But oh, poor Mr. Norrell. To be told that magic was not serious was a very heavy blow. To find himself classed with the dream ditches and the vinculuses of this world was a crushing one. In vain he protested that he had thought long and hard about how to make magic respected once more. In vain he offered to show Sir Walter a long list of recommendations concerning the regulation of magic in England. Sir Walter did not wish to see them. He shook his head and smiled, but all he said was,
"I'm afraid, Mr. Norrell, that I can do nothing for you."
When Mr. Drawlight arrived at Hanover Square that evening, he was obliged to listen to Mr. Norrell lamenting the failure of all his hopes of succeeding with Sir Walter Pole.
"Well, sir, what did I tell you?" cried Drawlight. "But oh, poor Mr. Norrell, how unkind they were to you. I'm very sorry for it, but I'm not in the least surprised. I've heard that those Wintertowns were stuffed full of pride."
But there was, I regret to say, a little duplicity in Mr. Drawlight's nature, and it must be said
that he was not quite as sorry as he professed to be. This display of independence had provoked him, and he was determined to punish Mr. Norrell for it. For the next week, Mr. Norrell and Mr. Drawlight attended only the quietest dinners, and without quite arranging matters so that Mr. Norrell would find himself the guest of Mr. Drawlight's shoemaker, or the old lady who dusts the monuments in Westminster Abbey, Mr. Drawlight took care that their hosts were people of as little consequence, influence, or fashion as possible. In this way, Drawlight hoped to create in Mr. Norrell the impression that not only the Poles in Wintertown slighted him, but the whole world, so that Mr. Norrell might be brought to understand who was his true friend, and might become a little more accommodating when it came to performing those small tricks of magic that Drawlight had been promising for many months now. Such were the hopes and schemes that animated the heart of Mr. Norrell's dearest friend. But unfortunately for Mr. Drawlight, so cast down was Mr. Norrell by Sir Walter's rejection that he scarcely noticed the change in the style of entertainments, and Drawlight succeeded in punishing no one but himself. Now that Sir Walter was quite beyond Mr. Norrell's reach, Mr. Norrell became more and more convinced that Sir Walter was exactly the patron he wished for. A cheerful, energetic man with pleasant, easy manners, Sir Walter Pole was everything that Mr. Norrell was not. Therefore, reasoned Mr. Norrell, Sir Walter Pole would have achieved everything that he could not. The influential men of the age would have listened to Sir Walter.
"If only he had listened to me," sighed Mr. Norrell one evening as he and Drawlight dined alone. "But I could not find the words to convince him. Of course, I wish now that I had asked you or Mr. Lascelles to come with me. Men of the world prefer to be talked to by other men of the world. I know that now. Perhaps I should have done some magic to show him, turn the teacups into rabbits or the teaspoons into goldfish. At least then he would have believed me. But I do not think the old lady would have been pleased if I had done that. I don't know. What is your opinion?"
But Drawlight, who had begun to believe that if anyone had ever died of boredom, then he was almost certain to expire within the next quarter of an hour, found that he had lost the will to speak, and the best he could manage was a withering smile. Chapter 7. An opportunity unlikely to occur again. October 1807.
"Well, sir, you have your revenge," cried Mr. Drawlight, appearing quite suddenly in the library in Hanover Square.
"My revenge?" said Mr. Norrell. "What do you mean?"
"Oh," said Mr. Drawlight, "Sir Walter's bride, Miss Wintertown, is dead. She died this very afternoon. They were to be married in 2 days' time, but poor thing, she is quite dead. £1,000 a year. Imagine his despair. Had she only contrived to remain alive until the end of the week, what a difference it would have made. His need of the money is quite desperate. He is all to pieces. I should not be at all surprised if we were to hear tomorrow that he had cut his throat."
Mr. Drawlight leant for a moment upon the back of a good, comfortable chair by the fire, and looking down, discovered a friend.
"Ah, Lascelles, I declare. There you are behind the newspaper, I see. How do you do?"
Meanwhile, Mr. Norrell stared at Mr. Drawlight.
"The young woman is dead, you say?"
he said in amazement.
"The young woman that I saw in that room? I can scarcely believe it. This is very unexpected."
"Oh, upon the contrary," said Drawlight. "Nothing was more probable."
"But the wedding," said Mr. Norrell, "all the necessary arrangements. They could not have known how ill she was."
"But I assure you," said Drawlight, "they did know. Everyone knew. Why, there was a fellow called Drummond who saw her at Christmas at a private ball in Leamington Spa and wagered Lord Carlisle £50 that she would be dead within a month."
Mr. Lascelles tuttered in annoyance and put down his newspaper.
"No, no," he said. "That was not Miss Wintertown. You're thinking of Miss Hookham Nix, whose brother had threatened to shoot her should she bring disgrace upon the family, which everyone supposes she must do sooner or later. But it happened at Worthing, and it was not Lord Carlisle who took the bet, but the Duke of Exmoor."
Drawlight considered this a moment.
"I believe you're right," he said at last. "But it does not matter, for everyone did know that Miss Wintertown was ill. Except, of course, the old lady. She thought her daughter perfection. And what can perfection have to say to ill health? Perfection is only to be admired. Perfection has only to make a great marriage.
but the old lady has never allowed that perfection might be ill. She could never bear to hear the subject mentioned. For all Miss Wintertown's coughs and swoonings upon the ground, and lyings down upon the sofa, I never heard that any physician ever came near her. Sir Walter would have taken better care of her, said Lascelles, shaking out his newspaper before he began once more to read it. One may say what one likes about his politics, but he is a sensible man. 'Tis a pity she could not have lasted till Thursday. But Mr. Norrell, said Drawlight, turning to their friend, you look quite pale and sick. You are shocked, I dare say, at the spectacle of a young and innocent life cut off. Your good feelings, as ever, do you credit, sir, and I am entirely of your opinion. The thought of the poor young lady crushed out of existence like a lovely flower beneath someone's boot. Well, sir, it cuts my heart like a knife. I can hardly bear to think of it. But then, you know, she was very ill, and must have died at some time or other, and by your own account she was not very kind to you. I know it's not the fashion to say so, but I am the sternest advocate in the world for young people giving respectful attention to scholarly old persons such as yourself. Impudence and sauciness and everything of that sort I hate. But Mr. Norrell did not appear to hear the comfort his friend was so kind as to give him, and when at last he spoke, his words seemed chiefly addressed to himself, for he sighed deeply and murmured, I never thought to find magic so little regarded here. He paused, and then said in a quick, low voice, It is a very dangerous thing to bring someone back from the dead. It has not been done in 300 years. I could not attempt it. This was rather extraordinary, and Mr. Drawlight and Mr. Lascelles looked round at their friend in some surprise. Indeed, sir, said Mr. Drawlight, and no one proposes that you should. Of course, I know the form of it, continued Mr. Norrell, as if Drawlight had not spoken. But it is precisely the sort of magic that I have set my face against. It relies so much, that is to say, the outcome must be entirely unpredictable, quite out of the magician's power to determine. And no, I shall not attempt it. I shall not even think of it.
There was a short silence. But despite the magician's resolve to think no more about the dangerous magic, he still fidgeted in his chair, and bit his finger ends, and breathed very quick, and exhibited other such signs of nervous agitation.
My dear Mr. Norrell, said Drawlight slowly, I believe I begin to perceive your meaning, and I must confess that I think the idea an excellent one. You have in mind a great act of magic, a testimony to your extraordinary powers. Why, sir, should you succeed, all the winter towns and poles in England will be on your doorstep soliciting the acquaintance of the wonderful Mr. Norrell.
And if he should fail, observed Mr. Lascelles dryly, everyone else in England will be shutting his door against the notorious Mr. Norrell.
My dear Lascelles, cried Drawlight, what nonsense you talk! Upon my word, there is nothing in the world so easy to explain as failure. It is, after all, what everybody does all the time.
Mr. Lascelles said that did not follow at all, and they were just beginning to argue about it, when an anguished cry burst from the lips of their friend, Mr. Norrell.
Oh, God, what shall I do? What shall I do? I have labored all these months to make my profession acceptable in the eyes of men, and still they despise me. Mr. Lascelles, you know the world. Tell me.
Alas, sir, interrupted Mr. Lascelles quickly. I make a great point of never giving advice to anyone.
And he went back to his newspaper.
My dear Mr. Norrell, said Drawlight,
who did not wait to be asked for his opinion,
such an opportunity is hardly likely to occur again.
A potent argument, this, and one which caused Mr. Norrell to sigh very deeply.
And I must say, I do not think that I could forgive myself if I allowed you to pass it by. With one stroke, you return to us that sweet young woman whose death no one can hear of without shedding a tear. You restore a fortune to a worthy gentleman, and you re-establish magic as a power in the realm for generations to come. Once you have proved the virtue of your skills, their utility and so forth, who will be able to deny magicians their dues of veneration and praise? They will be quite as much respected as admirals, a great deal more than generals, and probably as much as archbishops and lord chancellors. I should not be at all surprised if His Majesty
did not immediately set up a convenient arrangement of degrees with magicians in ordinary and magicians canonical, non-stipendary magicians and all that sort of thing. And you, Mr. Norrell, at the top as arch-magician. And all this with one stroke, sir. With one stroke.
Drawlight was pleased with this speech. Lascelles, rustling the paper in his irritation, clearly had a great many things to say in contradiction of Drawlight, but had put it out of his power to say any of them by his declaration that he never gave advice.
"There is scarcely any form of magic more dangerous," said Mr. Norrell in a sort of horrified whisper. "It is dangerous to the magician and dangerous to the subject."
"Well, sir," said Drawlight reasonably, "I suppose you are the best judge of the danger as it applies to yourself. But the subject, as you term her, is dead. What worse can befall her?"
Drawlight waited for a moment for a reply to this interesting question, but Mr. Norrell made none.
"I shall now ring for the carriage," Drawlight declared, and did so. "I shall go immediately to Brunswick Square. Have no fear, Mr. Norrell. I have every expectation that all our proposals will meet with the most ready acquiescence on all sides. I shall return within the hour."
After Drawlight had hurried away, Mr. Norrell sat for a quarter of an hour or so, simply staring in front of him. And though Lascelles did not believe in the magic that Mr. Norrell said would be done, nor therefore in the danger that Mr. Norrell said would be braved, he was glad he could not see what Mr. Norrell seemed to see. Then Mr. Norrell roused himself and took down 5 or 6 books in a great hurry and opened them up, presumably searching out those passages which were full of advice for magicians who wished to awaken dead young ladies. This occupied him until another 3/4 of an hour had passed, when a little bustle could be heard outside the library, and Mr. Drawlight's voice preceded him into the room.
"The greatest favour in the world, so very much obliged to you."
Mr. Drawlight danced through the library door, his face one immense smile.
"All is well, sir. Sir Walter did hold back a little at first, but all is well. He asked me to convey to you his gratitude for your kind attention, but he did not think that it could do any good. I said that if he were thinking of the thing getting out afterwards and being talked about, then he need not fear at all, for we had no wish to see him embarrassed, and Mr. Norrell's one desire was to be of service to him, and that Lascelles and I were discretion itself. But he said he didn't mind about that, for people would always laugh at a minister, only he'd rather Miss Wintertown were left sleeping now, which he thought more respectful of her present situation."
"My dear Sir Walter," cried I, "how can you say so? You cannot mean that a rich and beautiful young lady would gladly quit this life on the very eve of her marriage, when you yourself were to be a happy man. Oh, Sir Walter," I said, "you may not believe in Mr. Norrell's magic, but what can it hurt to try?" Which the old lady saw the sense of immediately, and added her arguments to mine. And she told me of a magician she had known in her childhood, a most talented person and a devoted friend to all her family, who had prolonged her sister's life several years beyond what anyone had expected. I tell you, Mr. Norrell, nothing can express the gratitude Mrs. Wintertown feels at your goodness, and she begs me to say to you that you are to come immediately. And Sir Walter himself says that he can see no sense in putting it off. So I told Davy to wait at the door and on no account to go anywhere else. Oh, Mr. Norrell, it is to be a night of reconciliations. All misunderstandings, all unfortunate constructions which may have been placed on one or two ill-chosen words, all are to be swept away. It is to be quite like a play by Shakespeare.
Mr. Norrell's greatcoat was fetched, and he got into the carriage, and from the expression of surprise upon his face when the carriage doors opened and Mr. Drawlight jumped in on one side and Mr. Lascelles jumped in on the other, I am tempted to suppose that he had not originally intended that these two gentlemen should accompany him to Brunswick Square. Lascelles threw himself into the carriage, snorting with laughter, and saying that he had never in his life heard of anything so ridiculous, and comparing their snug drive through the London streets in Mr. Norrell's carriage to ancient French and Italian fables, in which fools set sail in milk pails to fetch the moon's reflection from the bottom of a duck pond. All of which might well have offended Mr. Norrell, had Mr. Norrell been in spirits to attend to him. When they arrived at Brunswick Square, they found gathered upon the steps a little crowd of people. Two men ran out to catch the horses' heads, and the light from the oil lamp above the steps showed the crowd to be a dozen or so of Mrs. Wintertown's servants,
all on the lookout for the magician who was to bring back their young lady. Human nature being what it is, I dare say there may have been a few among them who were merely curious to see what such a man might look like. But many showed in their pale faces signs that they'd been grieving, and these were, I think, prompted by some nobler sentiment to keep their silent vigil in the cold midnight street. One of them took a candle and went before Mr. Norrell and his friends to show them the way, for the house was very dark and cold. They were upon the staircase when they heard Mrs. Wintertown's voice calling out from above,
"Robert! Robert! Is it Mr. Norrell? Oh, thank God, sir!"
She appeared before them very suddenly in a doorway.
"I thought you would never come."
And then, much to Mr. Norrell's consternation, she took both his hands in her own, and pressing them hard, entreated him to use his most potent spells to bring Miss Wintertown back to life. Money was not to be thought of. He might name his price. Only say that he would return her darling child to her. He must promise her that he would. Mr. Norrell cleared his throat, and was perhaps about to embark upon one of his long, uninteresting expositions of the philosophy of modern magic, when Mr. Drawlight glided forward, took Miss Wintertown's hands, and rescued them both.
"Now I beg of you, my dear madam," cried Drawlight,
"to be more tranquil. Mr. Norrell is come, as you see, and we must try what his power may do. He begs that you will not mention payment again. Whatever he does tonight will be done for friendship's sake."
And here Mr. Drawlight stood upon tiptoes and lifted his chin to look over Mrs. Wintertown's shoulder to where Sir Walter Pole was standing within the room. Sir Walter had just risen from his chair and stood a little way off regarding the newcomers. In the candlelight he was pale and hollow-eyed, and there was about him a kind of gauntness which had not been there before. Mere common courtesy said that he ought to have come forward to speak to them, but he did not do so. It was curious to observe how Mr. Norrell hesitated in the doorway and exhibited great unwillingness to be conducted further into the house until he had spoken to Sir Walter.
"But I must just speak to Sir Walter, just a few words with Sir Walter. I shall do my utmost for you, Sir Walter," he called out from the door. "Since the young lady is not long gone from us, I may say that the situation is promising. Yes, I think I may go so far as to say that the situation is a promising one. I shall go now, Sir Walter, and do my work. I hope in due course I shall have the honour of bringing you good news."
All the assurances that Mrs. Wintertown begged for, and did not get from Mr. Norrell, Mr. Norrell was now anxious to bestow upon Sir Walter, who clearly did not want them. From his sanctuary in the drawing-room, Sir Walter nodded, and then, when Mr. Norrell still lingered, he called out hoarsely,
"Thank you, sir, thank you,"
and his mouth stretched out in a curious way. It was, perhaps, meant for a smile.
"I wish with all my heart, Sir Walter," called out Mr. Norrell, "that I might invite you to come up with me and see what it is I do. But the curious nature of this particular magic demands solitude. I will, I hope, have the honour of showing you some magic upon another occasion."
Sir Walter bowed slightly and turned away. Mrs. Wintertown was at that moment speaking to her servant Robert, and Drawlight took advantage of this slight distraction to pull Mr. Norrell to one side and whisper frantically in his ear,
"No, no, sir, do not send them away. My advice is to gather as many of them around the bed as can be persuaded to come. It is, I assure you, the best guarantee of our night's exploits being generally broadcast in the morning. And do not be afraid of making a little bustle to impress the servants. Your best incantations, if you please. Oh, what a noodlehead I am! Had I only thought to bring some Chinese powders to throw in the fire. I don't suppose that you have any about you."
Mr. Norrell made no reply to this, but asked to be brought without delay to where Miss Wintertown was. But though the magician particularly asked to be taken there alone, his dear friends, Mr. Drawlight and Mr. Lascelles, were not so unkind as to leave him to face this great crisis of his career alone. And consequently, the three of them together were conducted by Robert to a chamber upon the second floor. Chapter 8. A Gentleman with Thistle-Down Hair. October 1807. There was no one there. Which is to say, there was someone there. Miss Wintertown lay upon the bed, but it would have puzzled philosophy to say now whether she were someone or no one at all. They had dressed her in a white gown and hung a silver chain about her neck. They had combed and dressed her beautiful hair and put pearl and garnet earrings in her ears. But it was extremely doubtful whether Miss Wintertown cared about such things any more. They had lit candles and laid a good fire in the hearth. They had put roses about the room, which filled it with a sweet perfume. But Miss Wintertown could have lain now with equal composure in the foulest-smelling garret in the city.
"And she was quite tolerable to look at, you say," said Mr. Lascelles.
"You never saw her?" said Drawlight. "Oh, she was a heavenly creature, quite divine, an angel."
"Indeed, and such a pinched-looking ruin of a thing now. I shall advise all the good-looking women of my acquaintance not to die," said Mr. Lascelles. He leaned closer.
"They've closed her eyes," he said.
"Her eyes were perfection," said Drawlight. "A clear dark grey with long dark eyelashes and dark eyebrows. It's a pity you never saw her. She was exactly the sort of creature you would have admired."
Drawlight turned to Mr. Norrell.
"Well, sir, are you ready to begin?"
Mr. Norrell was seated in a chair next to the fire. The resolute, business-like manner which he had adopted on his arrival at the house had disappeared. Instead, he sat with neck bowed, sighing heavily, his gaze fixed upon the carpet. Mr. Lascelles and Mr. Drawlight looked at him with that degree of interest appropriate to the character of each, which is to say that Mr. Drawlight was all fidgets and bright-eyed anticipation, and Mr. Lascelles all cool, smiling skepticism. Mr. Drawlight took a few respectful steps back from the bed so that Mr. Norrell might more conveniently approach it, and Mr. Lascelles leant against a wall and crossed his arms, an attitude he often adopted in the theatre. Mr. Norrell sighed again.
"Mr. Drawlight, I've already said that this particular magic demands complete solitude. I must ask you to wait downstairs."
"Oh, but sir," protested Drawlight, "surely such intimate friends as Lascelles and I can be of no inconvenience to you. We are the quietest creatures in the world. In 2 minutes' time, you will have quite forgotten that we're here, and I must say that I consider our presence as absolutely essential. For who will broadcast the news of your achievement tomorrow morning if not Lascelles and myself? Who will describe the ineffable grandeur of the moment when your magicianship triumphs and the young woman rises from the dead? Or the unbearable pathos of the moment when you are forced to admit defeat? You will not do it half so well yourself, sir. You know that you will not."
"Perhaps," said Mr. Norrell. "But what you suggest is entirely impossible. I will not, cannot begin until you leave the room."
Poor Drawlight. He could not force the magician to begin the magic against his will, but to have waited so long to see some magic and then be excluded, it was almost more than he could bear. Even Mr. Lascelles was a little disappointed, for he had hoped to witness something very ridiculous that he could laugh at. When they had gone, Mr. Norrell rose wearily from his seat and took up a book that he had brought with him. He opened it at a place he had marked with a folded letter and placed it upon a little table so that it would be to hand if he needed to consult it. Then he began to recite a spell. It took effect almost immediately, because suddenly there was something green where nothing green had been before, and a fresh, sweet smell as of woods and fields wafted through the room. Mr. Norrell stopped speaking. Someone was standing in the middle of the room, a tall, handsome person with pale, perfect skin and an immense amount of hair, as pale and shining as thistledown. His cold blue eyes glittered, and he had long, dark eyebrows which terminated in an upward flourish. He was dressed exactly like any other gentleman, except that his coat was of the brightest green imaginable, the color of leaves in early summer.
"Hola," began Mr. Norrell in a quavering voice. "Hola, magnum opus est mihi tua auxilio. Haec virgo mortua est et familia eos iam ad vitam redire vult."
Footnote 1. "O fairy, I have great need of your help. This virgin is dead, and her family wish her to be returned to life." Mr. Norrell pointed to the figure on the bed. At the sight of Miss Wintertown, the gentleman with the thistledown hair suddenly became very excited. He spread wide his hands in a gesture of surprised delight, and began to speak Latin very rapidly. Mr. Norrell, who was more accustomed to seeing Latin written down or printed in books, found that he could not follow the language when it was spoken so fast, though he did recognize a few words here and there, words such as Formosa and Venusta, which are descriptive for feminine beauty. Mr. Norrell waited until the gentleman's rapture had subsided, and then he directed the gentleman's attention to the mirror above the mantelpiece. A vision appeared of Miss Wintertown walking along a narrow rocky path through a mountainous and gloomy landscape.
Ecce motua inter taram et caelum, declared Mr. Norrell. Sito igitur, o la, me ad hanc magnum operum de eglisa quie.
Footnote 2. Here is the dead woman between earth and heaven. Know then, O fairy, that I have chosen you for this great task, because...
Yes, yes, cried the gentleman, suddenly breaking into English. You elected to summon me because my genius for magic exceeds that of all the rest of my race. Because I have been the servant and confidential friend of Thomas Godbless, Ralph Stokesay, Martin Pale, and of the Raven King. Because I am valorous, chivalrous, generous, and as handsome as the day is long. That is all quite understood. It would have been madness to summon anyone else. We both know who I am. The question is, who in the world are you?
I, said Mr. Norrell, startled, I am the greatest magician of the age.
The gentleman raised one perfect eyebrow, as if to say he was surprised to hear it. He walked around Mr. Norrell slowly, considering him from every angle. Then, most disconcerting of all, he plucked Mr. Norrell's wig from his head and looked underneath it, as if Mr. Norrell were a cooking pot on the fire and he wished to know what was for dinner.
I am the man who is destined to restore magic to England, stammered Mr. Norrell, grabbing back his wig and replacing it slightly askew upon his head.
Well, obviously, you are that, said the gentleman, or I should not be here. You do not imagine that I would waste my time upon a threepenny hedge sorcerer, do you? But who are you? That is what I wish to know. What magic have you done? Who was your master? What magical lands have you visited? What enemies have you defeated? Who are your allies?
Mr. Norrell was extremely surprised to be asked so many questions, and he was not at all prepared to answer them. He wavered and hesitated before finally fixing upon the only one to which he had a sensible answer.
I had no master. I taught myself.
How?
From books.
Books?
This in a tone of the utmost contempt.
Yes, indeed. There is a great deal of magic in books nowadays. Of course, most of it is nonsense. No one knows as well as I how much nonsense is printed in books. But there is a great deal of useful information, too, and it is surprising how, after one has learnt a little, one begins to see...
Mr. Norrell was beginning to warm to his subject. But the gentleman with the thistle-down hair had no patience to listen to other people talk, and so he interrupted him.
Am I the first of my race that you have seen?
Oh, yes.
This answer seemed to please the gentleman with the thistle-down hair, and he smiled.
So, should I agree to restore this young woman to life? What would be my reward?
Mr. Norrell cleared his throat.
What sort of thing?
He said a little hoarsely.
Oh, that is easily agreed, cried the gentleman with the thistle-down hair. My wishes are the most moderate things in the world. Fortunately, I am utterly free from greed and sordid ambition. Indeed, you will find that my proposal is much more to your advantage than mine. Such is my unselfish nature. I simply wish to be allowed to aid you in all your endeavours, to advise you upon all matters, and to guide you in your studies. Oh, and you must take care to let all the world know that your greatest achievements are due in larger part to me.
Mr. Norrell looked a little ill. He coughed and muttered something about the gentleman's generosity.
Were I the sort of magician who is eager to entrust all his business to another person, then your offer would be most welcome, but... Unfortunately, I fear, in short, I have no notion of employing you, or indeed any other member of your race, ever again.
A long silence.
Well,
"This is ungrateful indeed," declared the gentleman coldly. "I have put myself to the trouble of paying you a visit. I have listened with the greatest good nature to your dreary conversation. I have borne patiently with your ignorance of the proper forms and etiquette of magic, and now you scorn my offer of assistance. Other magicians, I may say, have endured all sorts of torments to gain my help. Perhaps I would do better to speak to the other one. Perhaps he understands better than you how to address persons of high rank and estate." The gentleman glanced about the room. "I do not see him. Where is he?"
"Where is who?"
"The other one."
"The other what?"
"Magician."
Mr.
Norrell began to form the word, but it died upon his lips.
"No, no, there is no other magician. I am the only one. I assure you, I am the only one. Why should you think that—"
"Of course there is another magician," declared the gentleman, as if it were perfectly ridiculous to deny anything quite so obvious. "He is your dearest friend in all the world."
"I have no friends," said Mr. Norrell.
He was utterly perplexed. Whom might the fairy mean? Childermas? Lascelles? Drawlight?
"He has red hair and a long nose, and he is very conceited, as are all Englishmen," declared the gentleman with the thistledown hair.
This was no help. Childermas, Lascelles, and Drawlight were all very conceited in their ways. Childermas and Lascelles both had long noses, but none of them had red hair. Mr. Norrell could make nothing of it, and so he returned with a heavy sigh to the matter in hand.
"You will not help me," he said. "You will not bring the young woman back from the dead?"
"I did not say so," said the gentleman with the thistledown hair,
in a tone which suggested that he wondered why Mr. Norrell should think that.
"I must confess," he continued, "that in recent centuries I have grown somewhat bored of the society of my family and servants. My sisters and cousins have many virtues to recommend them, but they are not without faults. They are, I'm sorry to say, somewhat boastful, conceited, and proud. This young woman," he indicated Miss Wintertown, "she had, I dare say, all the usual accomplishments and virtues. She was graceful, witty, vivacious, capricious, danced like sunlight, rode like the wind, sang like an angel, embroidered like Penelope, spoke French, Italian, German, Breton, Welsh, and many other languages."
Mr. Norrell said he supposed so. He believed that those were the sorts of things young ladies did nowadays.
"Then she will be a charming companion for me," declared the gentleman with the thistledown hair, clapping his hands together.
Mr. Norrell licked his lips nervously.
"What exactly are you proposing?"
"Grant me half the lady's life, and the deal is done."
"Half her life?" echoed Mr. Norrell.
"Half," said the gentleman with the thistledown hair.
"But what would her friends say if they learnt that I had bargained away half her life?"
asked Mr. Norrell.
"Oh, they will never know anything of it. You may rely upon me for that," said the gentleman.
"Besides, she has no life now. Half a life is better than none."
Half a life did indeed seem a great deal better than none. With half a life, Miss Wintertown might marry Sir Walter and save him from bankruptcy. Then Sir Walter might continue in office and lend his support to all Mr. Norrell's plans for reviving English magic. But Mr. Norrell had read a great many books in which were described the dealings of other English magicians with persons of this race, and he knew very well how deceitful they could be. He thought he saw how the gentleman intended to trick him.
"How long is a life?" he asked.
The gentleman with the thistledown hair spread his hands in a gesture of the utmost candor.
"How long would you like?"
Mr. Norrell considered.
"Let us suppose she had lived until she was 94. 94 would have been a good age. She is 19 now. That would be another 75 years. If you were to bestow upon her another 75 years, then I see no reason why you should not have half of it."
75 years, then," agreed the gentleman with the thistledown hair. "Exactly half of which belongs to me."
Mr. Norrell regarded him nervously.
"Is there anything more we must do?" he asked. "Shall we sign something?"
"No,"
but I should take something of the lady's to signify my claim upon her. Take one of these rings, suggested Mr. Norrell, or this necklace about her neck. I'm sure I can explain away a missing ring or necklace.
No, said the gentleman with the thistle-down hair. It ought to be something...
Ah, I know.